From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If the Kadima Party wins the Israeli elections at the end of the month, acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says the party will go forward with unilateral withdrawals from the West Bank. Meanwhile, some settlers in the West Bank say commitment to settlements is the only way to ensure the survival of Israel. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the history of the settlements with journalist Gershom Gorenberg, author of the new book, The Accidental Empire. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new ABC show, Sons and Daughters, from executive producer Lorne Michaels. It's a hybrid sitcom, improvisational humor mixed with scripted comedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The future of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories continues to be one of the most contentious issues dividing Israelis and Palestinians. Even within Israel, there are strong disagreements about whether the settlements have helped or hurt the country. Before his massive stroke, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon led the unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza and parts of the West Bank. Israel's acting prime minister, Ehud Olmert, says he will evacuate additional West Bank settlements if his Kadima party wins the election on March 28th. Any withdrawal would likely be unilateral, since Hamas, which now dominates the Palestinian government, doesn't recognize Israel. My guest, Gershom Gorenberg, has written a history of the Israeli settlements and the controversies surrounding their creation. It's called The Accidental Empire. He's a former columnist for the Jerusalem Report and is now the Jerusalem correspondent for The Forward in New York. Gershom Gorenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why is there so much at stake for every side now in the future of the settlements?
Well, the settlements were put in the occupied territories in order to stake an Israeli claim to that land. They've also resulted in a situation where there's an overlapping population of Israelis and Palestinians through the West Bank, and that makes it much more difficult for Israel to pull out of that area. Since the most commonly agreed and most realistic solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would be some sort of pullback, there is a tremendous tension around the issue of how that could take place, given that the settlements are there.
Now, we think of many of the settlements as having their major support from the religious right in Israel. But the first settlement, you say, after the Six-Day War in 1967, the settlement was made up of supporters of secular leftists.
Yes, that's correct. The original impulse, I think, to settle in the occupied territories really came out of the tradition of the left. The so-called labor Zionist movement was really built around the idea of settling the land, of Jews returning to the soil, and that had been a major part of its program before Israel's establishment in 1948. And for many of the people who are now Israel's leaders, people in their middle age or older, the results of the 1967 war, the conquest of new territory, presented to them a vision of the possibility of returning to the heroic days of their youth of settling the land. And many of them were very excited about this possibility. And that was one of the impulses that led to the establishment of the very first settlements beyond the pre-67 lines.
So are you saying some of the first settlements weren't about claiming land in the occupied territories as part of a greater Israel? It was about returning to the land?
Well, all these factors were involved. There was the allure of settling the land as such. There was a sense that the pre-67 boundaries had left Israel very vulnerable. And for some of the people, including on the left, there was an attachment to a larger homeland, a sense that the pre-67 borders had truncated the land of Israel. A dream remained of larger land. Every revolution ends up with less than its proponents dream of. In the case of the establishment of Israel, for some people at least, the difference between the dream and the reality was marked on the map. And the 67 war gave some of those people the sense that now they could realize some of the dreams that had seemed to be lost in 1948.
You reprint a memo that was written just after the 67 war by Theodore Meron, who was the legal counsel of the foreign ministry in Israel. And he writes, "My conclusion is that civilian settlements in the administered territories contravenes the explicit provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention." What did he mean, and what do you think is the significance of this 1967 memo?
Well, what he meant is that establishing Israeli civilian settlements over the pre-67 boundaries would be a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which bars an occupying party from settling its citizens, its civilians, in occupied land. He came to the conclusion that that prohibition applied not only to the Golan Heights, but also to the West Bank, and that Israel should not create civilian settlements in that territory. The memo has a couple of implications. One implication is that he was asked for it, which is to say that in early September of 1967, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol was already considering approving settlement in the occupied territories, and he was explicitly looking for what the legal parameters were in this case. The second implication is that after Meron wrote that memo and gave it to the foreign minister and it was passed on to the prime minister, that Israeli leaders were aware that their best expert on the subject believed that creating civilian settlements in the occupied territories would violate international law. Now, there was one loophole or implication of a loophole in the Meron memo, and that was that military bases, clearly temporary in nature, could be established under international law in occupied territory. So the first officially approved settlements in the West Bank and in the Golan Heights were labeled as belonging to a branch of the army that set up paramilitary outposts, outposts that were attached to the army, where the settlers belonged to the army, were soldiers, but also farmed the land. And officially, that was the framework of the settlements. But in the case of the first settlement that the government approved, that was a fiction. And so I would say that the use of the fiction itself indicated that the government accepted that this memo was valid and was trying to exploit the loophole in it.
How controversial were the first settlements in Israel among Israelis?
At the beginning, I think that the controversy was really minimal. For one reason, the government tended at the start to be very quiet about its settlement activities. There were a couple of reasons for that. First of all, there was a lot of indecision in the government itself about whether to settle in the occupied territories. The whole settlement enterprise did not develop as a result of a single overarching decision that Israel was going to keep these territories and put up settlements everywhere. It was much more a result of not being able to reach an overall decision about the future of the territories, not being certain what the diplomatic future would hold, and therefore making tiny steps here and there. A second reason that the government was quiet is that that was the political tradition of the ruling party, was to act quietly, not to make grand declarations. And as things developed, also some of the people who were in charge of the settlement effort were people who had a great love for secrecy. So the establishment of new settlements was not normally trumpeted in public. It also took place in areas in which most Israelis could agree that there was an Israeli security interest in holding on to that land. I think the first real controversy broke out about settlement nearly a year after the 1967 war, when settlers moved into the West Bank city of Hebron on a wildcat basis without government approval, and then after the fact got government approval to stay there. That upset people, or at least some people in the country, because it was done without government approval. It made the setting of foreign policy a private initiative, and because the idea of settling within an Arab city seemed particularly provocative and particularly likely to create conflict between Arabs and Jews. That's the first place I pick up signs of any protest in the public.
You mentioned that the first settlement was made up of secular leftists. How did the settlement movement become primarily made up of religious Zionists?
Well, there was a generational gap when right after the 1967 war. The people who were the aging founders of the state, who were trying to go back to their youth, were very excited about setting up new settlements. But you don't establish new farming kibbutzim, communes with guys in their 50s. You do that with young people. And interestingly enough, their own young people were mostly apathetic to the idea. It was very, very hard for them to recruit young settlers, either from the kibbutz movement or from the city socialist youth movements that you normally drew settlers from. And so there was always a lack of manpower. And a new theology had caught on among young religious Israelis, a theology that said that the establishment of the state and the 1967 war were proof that the process of final redemption was taking place, that God was returning the Holy Land to the Jewish people. And so people felt that by settling in the occupied territories, they were becoming part of this divine pattern. And so young religious Israelis jumped into the vacuum that was left by the lack or the dearth of secular settlers.
Would you describe a little bit more what the religious philosophy was behind those early settlements?
Well, this was a theology which had essentially taken secular nationalism and made it religious. Secular nationalism makes the ultimate value the nation, our religion, our land, our people. In its origins, it's really a challenge to religion. It says that instead of God being the most important thing, the nation is. What had happened was that people who wanted to be part of both, who wanted to be religious and part of the nationalist mainstream, took nationalism and made it into a religious value again. And part of the way that they did that is that they said, what God wants is for his people to return to their land. That's why this is happening. The secular Zionists who are coming back and settling the land don't realize it, but they're really doing God's work. And we, who are aware of the real pattern, we can do it even better. And so we can go and settle the land, and we'll be, so they were saying to themselves, so these religious settlers were saying to themselves, we can be the ideal settlers because we'll have the consciousness of what it's really about. We'll understand that we're doing God's work, and we will be bringing the redemption closer, the final conclusion of history closer, by settling the land, because that's what God wants us to do.
Was part of this, did part of this have to do with the belief that the territories that were being settled were part of what was defined as Israel in biblical times, and therefore it should remain part of Israel?
There was very much a sense that the land that was conquered in 1967, particularly the West Bank, but the rest of the land as well, was part of the land promised to the Jewish people, to the people of Israel, by God in the Bible. Many of the places that were conquered were ones where central events took place in the Bible. A classic example of this is the city of Hebron in the West Bank, which was the city where traditionally it's believed that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were buried. And there's a tomb there that is supposed to be their tomb, and it's the city where King David began his first ruled as king. And many, many other places in the occupied territories were places that you read about in the Bible. This was a feeling, by the way, that went beyond simply the religious public. Friends of mine who were children at the time have told me of parents taking them through the West Bank the first summer after the conquest, the summer of 1967, Bible in hand, and reading out verses about the events that took place at whatever spot they were visiting. In secular Israel, the Bible was very much regarded as the national epic, the connection between Jews and their land. So there was a love affair based upon the Bible with much of the land that was conquered. The question which confronted all of Israel at that time was the balance between those romantic feelings toward the land and the practical considerations.
My guest is journalist Gershom Gorenberg, author of the new book, The Accidental Empire. We'll talk more about the history of the Israeli settlements after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Gershom Gorenberg. His new book, The Accidental Empire, is about the creation of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. After the Six-Day War of 1967, did the religious and the secular settlers get along with each other, even though their motivations were different?
Oh, yes. At the beginning, I don't think that the conflict arose. There's accounts of secular and religious settlers meeting each other, feeling that they have a common purpose, even though they had really grown up in different communities and weren't terribly familiar with each other. I don't think that they had a full sense yet of the difference between their ideologies. It was at a later stage, really after the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when the religious settlers began pressing to settle in areas of the West Bank that the government had kept out of bounds, that the conflict between the religious settlers and the secular leadership of the country and even other settlement groups became much more pronounced. The government was trying to balance between the desire to improve Israel's borders from a security point of view, the basic sense of connection to this land as being part of the Jewish homeland, those things on one side, and on the other side, the recognition that there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living in those territories. The government policy did not want to see those areas, the heavily populated areas of the West Bank, annexed to Israel, because the result would be to turn Israel into a binational state. And repeatedly, politicians within the ruling parties warned that if you annexed the West Bank, you would end up with actually the end of the Zionist enterprise. You would create a binational state instead of a Jewish state. So the de facto policy that the government worked out was to put up settlements in areas where there was very little Arab population and to leave the parts of the West Bank that were heavily populated free of settlements. The religious settlers did not accept these restrictions. After 1973, when the government first began negotiating with Arab countries over possible peace arrangements, it became clear that some territory might be given back. That scared the religious settlers that they might lose the chance to hold on to that territory. At the same time, the government had really been weakened by the 1973 war, which was a total surprise to Israel. It really damaged the credibility of the government. So it was a good opportunity for a protest movement to assert itself, to claim to be more patriotic, to be the real protector of the nation. And in that situation, the religious settlers began pressing to settle in the parts of the West Bank that the government had kept out of bounds. That's when the confrontation developed.
Your book begins with a confrontation at a train station near a settlement. And this was members of the Gush Emunim settlement in confrontation with the government. Let's start with what Gush Emunim represents in the settlement movement.
Okay. Gush Emunim was a protest movement which arose after the Yom Kippur War of 1973. It was composed mainly of young religious Israelis who believed very deeply in a theology which said that Israel had to hold on to all of the territory that it had conquered, that doing so was part of the process of final redemption. It saw the government as being weak, as not sufficiently standing up for Jewish rights, and it saw itself, the young religious Jews, as being the vanguard of the Jewish nation, the people who would press the national goals, who would succeed in the national goals the best. And very quickly, it adopted as its main tactic in confronting the government the attempt to establish settlements in the northern West Bank, in areas where there was a very large Palestinian population, as a statement that Israel would not give up this land. And a series of confrontations developed between the summer of 1974 and the winter of 1975, where time and again, sometimes dozens, sometimes thousands of young protesters would show up at a particular spot in the West Bank and declare that they were establishing a settlement there. And time again, the soldiers were sent in, and the would-be settlers were dragged out and put on buses and pulled out of the settlement site. And sometimes secular politicians would show up to support them. In one of the most famous incidents, the freshman Knesset member, parliament member, Ariel Sharon, who was a famous general, showed up at one of the settlement attempts and ran running from soldier to soldier, telling them that their orders to evacuate the settlers were illegal and that they should disobey those orders. And time and again, despite that, the settlers were removed. Finally, in December of 1975, one major attempt was made by Gush Emunim to establish a settlement. And one of the reasons that Gush Emunim felt that it could succeed this time is that the United Nations had recently passed the resolution equating Zionism with racism. And there was tremendous anger in Israel, really at the world, a sense of isolation, a sense of defiance. And Gush Emunim picked up on this and felt that it would have a large amount of public support beyond the religious community for settling and for showing that Israel wasn't giving in to international pressure. In that way, the Arab diplomatic victory at the UN really contributed to Gush Emunim's push in 1975.
Gershom Gorenberg will continue the story in the second half of the show. He's the author of a new book about the creation of the Israeli settlements called The Accidental Empire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, working with its customers throughout the month of March to help America's second harvest in the fight against hunger here at home at secondharvest.org. From the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, funding programs in California and Israel in the areas of health, higher education, and the arts. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with journalist Gershom Gorenberg on the history of the Israeli settlements. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Sons and Daughters, a new ABC comedy premiering tonight. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gershom Gorenberg, author of the new book, The Accidental Empire, about the history of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories and the controversies surrounding their creation. Gorenberg is a former columnist for the Jerusalem Report and is now Jerusalem correspondent for The Forward in New York. When we left off, he was discussing what he describes as a turning point in the history of the settlements, when members of Gush Emunim made a major push to establish an illegal settlement in the West Bank in December 1975.
thousands of young people gathered at this abandoned train station near the city of Nablus. It was a Hanukkah vacation, winter vacation from school, which meant that there were lots and lots of teenagers available as protesters, and they showed up in droves. And the government began to get very afraid of the confrontation that would be involved in dragging these protesters away.
So would you describe what the confrontation was like and how it developed?
Well, what happened was that the settlers began marching in, or actually they started to try to drive in from Israel proper to this train station in the hills of the West Bank. Soldiers had been told in advance to set up roadblocks to stop them. When the cars were stopped at the roadblocks, the people got out of the cars and continued marching on foot. There was a festival atmosphere among the protesters, that kind of euphoria which can develop when there's a large crowd of young people who feel that all of their friends are there, that everybody is there. They march to the site. They set up tents. The soldiers were sent in to surround them, but the government was very afraid of the confrontation of removing them. And the confrontation dragged on for day after day until the would-be settlers had been there for a week. There were several thousand of them. And the government was at its wit's end what to do about the situation. It didn't want to let the settlers stay, and it didn't want the violent confrontation with them. And at that point, the defense minister, who was Shimon Peres, was sent to negotiate with the settlers. Peres was sent because he was defense minister. As defense minister, he was responsible for the occupied territories, so it was in his bailiwick. Part of the problem was that within the government, Peres was actually one of the main supporters of settlement in that area. In those days, Peres was perhaps the most hawkish member of the ruling Labor Party and had a tremendous rivalry with Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister. The two men actually despised each other passionately. So Peres went up there to talk to the settlers. In the midst of his conversations with them, he told them that they would have to leave, that the government had said that they would have to leave. There was great tension in the room, and then a compromise was proposed that 30 of the settlers would be allowed to stay in a military base nearby while the government had time to consider its policy on settling in this area. And to avoid the confrontation, the government adopted that compromise. The settlers actually met one more time with Peres, who expanded the compromise to be 30 families, and that they would be given the opportunity to earn a livelihood through the army. The changes in the compromise actually made the settlers' presence in the army base much more of a real settlement. And the government, which was supposed to debate this within 2 to 3 months, actually put the debate off for 5 months. And when it finally did debate what to do with those settlers, it said, well, they'll have to move to another spot. But it didn't say what would happen if they didn't. Again, the government was very afraid of confrontation with the settlers.
And why was the government so afraid of confrontation with the settlers?
Well, the government was afraid of confronting people who seemed to stand for patriotism, who seemed to stand for the national ideals. Idealism was standing up to pragmatism, and the government was nervous that it would look like it was less committed to the national ideals. That was one reason. A second reason was that within Israel, it was very difficult to send Israeli troops to confront other Jews. It was a young country. The sense of being one group of people together was very strong, and the sense of the government as protecting the law was weaker. So that particularly affected the mass demonstrations, but it even affected the situation afterwards. And the Rabin government itself was extremely weak. It was divided. There were people of very different political perspectives within it. Rabin and Shimon Peres were constantly in conflict, and that made it much more difficult for the government to make a decision.
Why do you see this confrontation between the Israeli government and Gush Emunim as being a turning point in the history of the settlements and of Israeli policy toward the settlements?
Well, First of all, the government lost control of its own settlement policy at that point. The activists had shown that they could determine where settlement would take place. One of the key defining characteristics of the state had disappeared. It wasn't the elected government wasn't determining foreign policy anymore. Secondly, the religious settlement movement, with its ideological commitment to not giving up a single inch, was now in the forefront. If beforehand there had been a secular leadership that had been in conflict with itself that could be best known by its own contradictions, its pull toward the romantic appeal of the land versus its practical fear of a binational state, now the people leading the settlement movement were ones who had no doubts, who knew exactly what the truth was, and who could push forward.
How would you compare the confrontation between Gushemanim and the Israeli government in the mid-70s with the confrontations this past summer as soldiers tried to remove settlers from the West Bank?
Well, what we saw this last summer when soldiers were removing settlers both from the West Bank and from the Gaza Strip is that, first of all, it was a much larger operation. This is something the settlers had been there for many years. The crisis involved was actually much greater. By not having dealt with the problem 20 years before, Israel was confronted with a much larger problem. People who had lived for years and years in the territories, who saw that as their home, who felt that the government had allowed them to stay there, the crisis actually was much greater. Of course, there was a tremendous irony that Sharon, the man who had called for disobeying orders 20 years before, was now the man calling for the evacuation, who'd finally come to the conclusion himself that some of the settlement, at least, was unsupportable and was leading Israel in the wrong direction.
Shortly after Ariel Sharon reversed his policy and had the military remove settlers from areas of the occupied territories, he had his stroke, he remains in a coma, and he'll never again lead the government. What is the policy now of Ehud Olmert, who's the acting prime minister and who's now at the top of the Kadima party, which Ariel Sharon co-founded? What is his policy toward the settlements?
Well, Olmert says that he's going to set the final borders of Israel in such a manner that he will guarantee that there's a Jewish majority in Israel. That is to say, Olmert, a long-time, lifetime member of the Israeli right, somebody born and bred in the tradition of keeping what's called the whole land of Israel, which means keeping the occupied territories, has now accepted one of the classic arguments of the dovish side of Israeli politics, which is that Israel must give up land in order to preserve its Jewish majority. It's clear that Olmert intends to evacuate at least some settlements. He still believes that he can hold on to many others. In a certain very basic way, Olmert has now arrived at the map that some people in the Labor Party were proposing in the mid-70s. The basic problem with that map remains that there is no Arab partner for such a deal. A further problem that Olmert has is that the Palestinian elections have brought to power within the Palestinian Authority a very hardline party, the Hamas party, which refuses to recognize Israel, which increases the feeling that there's no partner for peace negotiations. Under those circumstances, in the last week, the talk has been again that Israel may, after the elections, carry out some sort of unilateral withdrawal from parts of the West Bank. That would inevitably mean removing some of the settlements, including some of the very hard-line settlements. So even under that very partial plan for withdrawal from the territories that Olmert's party is talking about, we can expect some extremely serious confrontations between the government and the hard-line settlers in the months or years ahead.
My guest is journalist Gershom Gorenberg, author of the new book, The Accidental Empire. We'll talk more about the history of the Israeli settlements after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is journalist Gershom Gorenberg. His new book, The Accidental Empire, is about the creation of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Before Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had his stroke, he led a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, as well as from some settlements in the West Bank. The leadership of Fatah was opposed to unilateral withdrawals, but Hamas has raised no objections. It's unwilling to negotiate with Israel anyway. I asked Gorenberg to explain the position of Hamas.
Well, I think that Hamas still sticks to an older Palestinian position which negates the existence of the State of Israel entirely, and which places it beyond the pale as a negotiating partner. There's really a terrible process going on here, which is that the two sides come closer to the recognition that the only solution is a partition of the shared, of the contested homeland. And then on one side or the other, there's a pulling away from that recognition. Ultimately, the basic problem is that there are two national groups. They both historically see the same piece of land as their homeland. And the only way to achieve peace between them is for each group to settle for less than its entire dream. Hamas has now gone back to saying, we can't settle for less than the whole dream. We might be willing to make a ceasefire with Israel if it pulls back to the 1967 boundaries, but that ceasefire is framed as being temporary. It implies that they really want to take the rest. And obviously, that does not create any great desire within Israel to negotiate with them.
How many settlers would you say there are now in the West Bank and Gaza? And who are they? What do they represent politically?
Okay, there are no more settlers in the Gaza Strip as of last summer. The latest Israeli government figures place the settler population in the West Bank at approximately 250,000. I would say that the best estimates that I've seen, very, very rough estimates, are that about 25% of those settlers belong to the hardline ideological settlement group, the successors of Gush Emunim. Gush Emunim as an organization has ceased to exist, but about 25% of the settlers probably are part of that tradition. A much larger proportion of them are people who were attracted to settlements over the years, essentially for the suburban dream. Particularly under the years of Likud right-wing rule in Israel, settlements were built very, very heavily subsidized, particularly close to the old borders. And for many Israelis, moving to a settlement was the first chance to get a private house with a backyard or simply a larger apartment under better terms. And that probably still represents the majority of the settler population.
How much of the support behind the settlements in the occupied territories has to do with security questions, with feeling that Israel is more secure with settlements in the territories?
I think that there's a very wide feeling among a large part of the Israeli public that Israel cannot afford to give up all of the territories for security reasons. On the other hand, over recent years, there's been a growing awareness in the public that the settlements as such, having civilians living in those territories, particularly in the scattered settlements deep in the West Bank, has become more and more of a security burden. People don't like the fact that their sons are having to go out and defend these settlements. I think that if we look at the current election campaign, what we can see is that decisively the Israeli mainstream, including the center-right, has fallen out of love with the vision of holding on to all of the territories. The question now has become how much to give up, how to get out. The relationship to the territories has become much more one of a quagmire where you're trying to figure out how can I safely get out of this and protect my security rather than one of an ideal of how can I keep this.
Ariel Sharon in the 70s contributed to the design of the settlements. I mean, he had this philosophy of fingers of settlements. Would you explain what that vision was that he contributed?
Yes, actually, Sharon's idea was to create fingers of Israeli settlement running through originally the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, breaking up Palestinian territory so that there would be no possibility of a viable Palestinian state. What would be left would be fragmented Palestinian enclaves, which would achieve some sort of low-level version of self-rule, but that there would be no possibility of a Palestinian state, which he saw as a threat to Israel. And so the high controlling ground of the West Bank would be settled. There would be settlements between each of the major Palestinian cities. And in that way, Palestinian independence would be thwarted.
I guess that's the ultimate paradox in Sharon's career, that he helped design the settlements so that the Palestinians couldn't achieve their own state. And then he was in the position later of thinking he had to pull back the settlements, and it was very difficult to do.
Yes, although, of course, the mystery of Ariel Sharon is how much he really intended to pull back, how much of a viable state for the Palestinians he really looked forward to. In a sense, that's a question we won't answer, and it doesn't really matter anymore. The major question is today is what does Ehud Olmert, who is the person most likely to become the next prime minister, what does he think Israel should do in terms of the settlements? How much is he willing to pull back? How much of a viable Palestinian state is he willing to countenance? And on the other side, will he have a peace partner who is willing to meet the essential conditions for making peace, which is recognizing the state of Israel and declaring willingness to live in peace with it? Those are the questions we confront.
If I might ask you one personal political question, are your politics being challenged at all?
Well, I certainly feel that the situation has become much more difficult. As I see it, the two-state solution is really the only way out of this. And negotiating with Hamas is very, very difficult unless they accept a two-state solution. I would say, however, that I would think that the best thing for Israel to do in this situation is, alongside of insisting that Hamas meet basic conditions for negotiating, that Israel also declare its willingness to give up territory and to see the creation of a viable Palestinian state if there's a Palestinian partner for that, because I believe that that would create popular pressure on the Palestinian side, popular pressure on the Hamas leadership to make concessions or simply to decide that they can't rule under those circumstances. Israel has some ability to create political momentum on the other side, just as the Palestinians have shown that they can affect the Israeli political situation.
The Bush administration wants to withhold financial aid from Hamas, from the Palestinian government, until Hamas agrees to recognize Israel. What are the different points of view within Israel about that position?
Well, I think that most people in Israel would agree that they don't want to see money flowing directly to a Hamas-led government for the fear that some of that money may go into terror activities. However, from close up, the situation is much more complicated than it appears from a distance. I would say that the Bush administration has a habit of responding more with a club than with a scalpel to difficult situations. In Israel, there is an awareness of opposite problems. If the Palestinian Authority collapses, will Israel have to take over civilian administration of the Palestinian towns again? That's a concern. If Israel has no communication with the Palestinian Authority, what happens if bird flu breaks out in the Palestinian Authority? Will our veterinarians not speak to their veterinarians? Who will take care of humanitarian needs? So I think a lot of these issues have to be finessed, fine-tuned very delicately. I would also say that the element which is missing from the Bush administration's policy here is the alternative. We're being told about the stick. We're not being told about the carrot. The polls of the Palestinian population continue to show majority support for a two-state solution. I think that if the Bush administration were clearly stating its position in favor of a two-state solution, that they would be presenting the Palestinian public with an alternative that it could embrace. And that would put pressure on the Palestinian Authority government, on Hamas, to accept a more moderate position. I think that the carrot has to be there as well as the stick.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Gershom Gorenberg is the author of the new book, The Accidental Empire. He's the Jerusalem correspondent for The Forward in New York. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the sitcom Sons and Daughters, which premieres tonight. This is Fresh Air. Tonight is the premiere of a new ABC sitcom produced by the company run by Lorne Michaels, the creator of Saturday Night Live. It's called Sons and Daughters, and our TV critic David Bianculli is pleasantly surprised.
One of the dirty truths of being a professional critic, don't worry, I won't tell you all of them, is that a critic never comes to the table with no expectations or without preconceived notions. Not if you've done your homework or even remembered what you've seen before. Depending upon the people behind a project and starring in it, you slide in the preview DVD hoping for the best, expecting the worst, or something in between. That doesn't mean there aren't surprises in store, good and bad. Tonight, for example, CBS premieres a new drama series called The Unit, about a top-secret military strike force and their wives back home. It's by playwright David Mamet, who wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, and TV writer-producer Sean Ryan, who created the gritty cop show The Shield. With those credentials and that pairing, expectations for The Unit are high. But the show itself is much more involving and convincing on the home front than during the military sequences. At best, it's an average show. Surprisingly average. On the other hand, there's the case of Gregory Thomas Garcia. He's the comedy writer who created Yes, Dear, a sitcom that for some inexplicable reason remains on the air. I disliked everything about Yes, Dear, so the fact that he had a new sitcom coming out at the start of this TV season filled me with nothing but dread, until I saw it and absolutely loved it. Somehow, the same guy who made Yes, Dear found it in himself to produce My Name is Earl, my favorite new comedy of the season. Well, here comes another surprise as pleasant as that one. Tonight, ABC premieres a new comedy, Sons and Daughters, heavily promoted as the new show from Saturday Night Live creator Lorne Michaels. It's true that Michaels is its executive producer, but Sons and Daughters, a sprawling comedy about three generations of an Ohio family, actually is the baby of a guy named Fred Goss. He's the co-creator and co-writer, he directs, and stars in it, too. He plays Cameron, a man on his second marriage dealing as best he can with a somewhat eccentric assortment of siblings, parents, children, and in-laws. Now here's where the game of not-so-great expectations plays a part. Fred Goss was one of the stars of Significant Others, the Showtime comedy in which married people vented their frustrations in couples therapy. That show was improvised by the cast, and it was barely watchable. So when the news arrived that Goss had structured and filmed Sons and Daughters the way Larry David does Curb Your Enthusiasm, outlining plot points very specifically, then letting actors improvise their own dialogue, I wasn't expecting much. When improv actors go bad, it can be a terrible thing to see. Just think of HBO's K Street. But Sons and Daughters is delightful. It's shot like Curb, with no audience and no laugh track, and has the same rapid pace as Arrested Development. This extended family, though, is less exaggerated, more grounded, and the cast is wonderful. The standouts for me are not only Fred Goss as Cameron, but Dee Wallace Stone and Max Gale as Cameron's parents, mother Colleen, and stepfather Wendell. Gale from Barney Miller is great here. On the day of his 25th wedding anniversary, Wendell is helping Cameron and his son work on a merit badge project in the garage, and he pulls Cameron aside to whisper some particularly ill-timed news.
I'm thinking about leaving your mom. Why? What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about. You know this? Can you see that nest up there? The henpecked warbler lives up there. You know, in that nest, which is related
to the. We're talking in bird code.
The get me out of here is immediacy.
Yes. Bitches, uninterruptus.
Here's what it's like. I got a better way of describing this. You know, you create this really wonderful box that you're stuck inside of. You know?
Sometimes I feel like I'm in a box. I do. And I love Liz, and I love the kids. You work it out.
I can take the old van. I got it all worked out. I can have that thing outfitted in a heartbeat.
What are you, Ken Kesey?
Scenes such as these are very funny, but they aren't played just for laughs. When word of Wendell's unhappiness spreads through the family and finally gets to his wife at their silver anniversary party, her reaction is crushingly serious. There's a depth here to the characters and to the show that makes Sons and Daughters another of this year's delightful primetime surprises.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Grammy Award winner Ali Farka Touré, a guitarist from Mali who introduced the style known as desert blues to international audiences. He had bone cancer and died in his sleep today. He was in his late 60s.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In testimony before Congress, political scientist James Thurber said the number of lobbyists, the type and sophistication of public advocacy tactics, and the amount of money spent on lobbying has grown dramatically in the last 30 years. On the next Fresh Air, he'll tell us how it's grown and talk about the K Street Project. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.